Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto from Dallas, Texas. Today, as I promised the last time, we're going to be talking about Mexico, and I'm very excited about not only the topic, and as you well know, we deal with this topic from time to time because of our proximity to Mexico, sharing a border with Mexico. Obviously, we're very concerned about what's happening down there. We've had other guests, and today we have a special guest, Hector Tobar, who is the bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Mexico City. Hector, how are you? Welcome.
Fine, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, Hector. We're looking forward to your comments and to your viewpoints. Let us begin by learning a little bit about Hector. I mean, how did you end up in Mexico City?
Well, I moved abroad for the LA Times in 2001. I was the Buenos Aires bureau chief for 4 years, and then in 2005, I moved here to Mexico, and I cover Mexico and Central America for the LA Times, a subject close to my heart because I am the son of Guatemalan immigrants. And before I joined the foreign desk, I was a roving national correspondent and a metro reporter for the LA Times, and I've been a journalist for many, many years.
Okay. All right, for a long time, huh? Very good. And how do you like living in Mexico City? I have many friends down there. I myself lived in Mexico City many years ago, but how do you like living in Mexico City?
Oh, it's been a wonderful experience. It's sort of like Los Angeles multiplied several times over and stacked on top of itself. You know, that it has the traffic problems. It's a very, of course, like Los Angeles, it's a very Latino city. You know, there's a lot of things here that remind me of home, of California, and there's a lot of things that are just really maddening and very different. It's an amazing city to live in. There's just so much happening, and my kids are now being educated here at the local school, so it's been a great experience.
What part of town do you live in, just out of curiosity?
I live in the Beverly Hills of Mexico City in Lomas de Chapultepec.
Oh, okay. Well, that's
maybe
a very pretty area.
About 4 blocks from the famous house mansion where the Chinese Mexicano had $204 million hidden in his house. That's where I live.
Oh, okay. So you must have had an exciting night. Whenever that happened, that must have been an exciting night in your neighborhood.
Yeah, it was. We were far enough away we didn't notice until the next morning. But I had dreams afterwards of finding little bags of money, you know, hidden somewhere around the neighborhood. But it never happened.
Okay. All right. Now I was looking at the internet, Hector, and I saw that you won a Pulitzer Prize. Did I read that correctly?
I was part of the team of reporters that we won a Pulitzer for covering the riots in 1992, and I was one of the reporters in the street that day, the first full day of the riots, covering it, and I had a story on the front page that day. And myself and my colleagues, we won that prize. That was quite an honor.
That is, because that is, as far as journalism is concerned, that is the ultimate honor, isn't it, to win the Pulitzer? That's something that I assume every reporter, every journalist, that's something you want. How do you win that? Are you submitted by the newspaper? Is that how it works?
Yes, you're submitted by the newspaper, and the Pulitzer Board decides, and we won it for breaking news, which is, for covering something that's happening at the moment.
And how many articles were part of this? What is it? Was it a series of articles or just one?
No, it was all one day's coverage. I think there were six or seven of our articles were submitted for that day's coverage, and including mine. And we won. So it was just for one day of in which a whole staff pulled together and covered that story.
That's great. Well, congratulations on that. I saw that on the internet this morning when I was preparing for the show, and that's you're the first Pulitzer Prize winner that we've had on the show, so that's a great honor. We've had other journalists, but you're the first one, so congratulations on that.
Thank
Let
you.
Me ask you a question. You were talking about breaking news in 1992. A lot has changed about the new newspaper business since 1992. If you were working for a newspaper today, let's say, and you had a riot like that or a breaking story like that, would you be doing more coverage on the internet, or would you be out on the street? How would that work? How has the internet changed the way you cover stories?
Well, I can tell you that here on the foreign desk, it's changed the way we cover stories, because we end up doing two or three versions of a story if it is something that there's a lot of interest in. For example, I covered some hurricanes recently, and I know that I was sending at least two or three different versions of the story during the day. I would send, for example, I was in this town, Felipe Carrillo Puerto, which is near where the eye of Hurricane Dean struck, and I took the satellite phone the LA Times provides me, and from the plaza of this pueblo, I filed my first version of my story. The final version I wrote that day, I wrote back in the hotel in Cancun. You know, I know that the internet means that we are doing, if it's a breaking story, it's something that we're updating constantly if we're able to.
How many other, just out of curiosity, I know part of the answer to the question I'm asking you, because I know the Dallas Morning News, our local paper, has a bureau there. Obviously, the New York Times does too, and the Wall Street Journal. I used to know the correspondent for the Wall Street Journal when I lived in Mexico. But how many other American newspapers have offices or staffs in Mexico City?
Oh, it has to be at least, I don't know, maybe about 10 or so. The Dallas Morning News, the Houston Chronicle, the Arizona Republic has a reporter here, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, just to name the ones off the top of my head immediately. So, and then there's the wire services also, the Associated Press and Reuters. It's a pretty big, it's a very, very large press corps.
Yeah. Now, do you guys get together much? Is there like a club of foreign correspondents or U.S. correspondents? Do you get together and share ideas?
We don't share ideas because we're all competing with each other. That's the last thing we talk about. We talk about everything else except for story ideas.
We
talk about... unless there's a particular story that we're all working on at the same time that everybody knows about, you know, let's say there were an earthquake or something, and we would talk about, you know, having covered that story. But when it comes to the ideas, the feature ideas that we're writing about, everybody sort of keeps that close to the vest because that's our stock in trade. That's how we separate ourselves from each other, is with our story ideas and the things that we're covering.
Well, let me ask you another question, too, about... your bureau in Mexico and the fact that Los Angeles has such a large Mexican population. Are many of your stories read by people in Los Angeles to sort of know what's happening in Mexico because they're Mexicans, or I mean, is that the idea of the bureau? I mean, to sort of keep the Mexican population in LA connected to their homeland?
Well, the idea of the bureau is that the LA Times has a foreign staff that covers all the entire globe. You know, we have correspondents in Africa and Asia, in Europe, and in Latin America. So I think from the paper's point of view, the first thing it's doing is it's trying to provide coverage of the entire world. That's part of what the LA Times sells. But in terms of Mexico, definitely one of our missions is to give people a window into a country that already has very strong cultural family links to Southern California. There's no doubt about it. I would say that I'm lucky in the sense that many times I receive emails from people who've lived in Mexico or lived in Central America. There's a very, very strong cultural connection, no doubt about it, between Los Angeles and this particular corner of Latin America.
Let me ask you a kind of a general question, and then we'll get into some of the subjects that I want to get your views on. If you were talking to, let's say, an American who's not very familiar because of distance or because of culture or for whatever reason, is not very familiar with why Mexico is important to the United States, what would you tell them? What would you say to this person? What are two or three things that make Mexico or what happens in Mexico important for an American national?
I would say, number one, we live in a globalized environment, a globalized world, where Latin America and especially Mexico provides much labor power to the United States. Of course, that's a big subject of debate in the United States, but it's been a reality for the last generation that much of the young labor force of the working class of the United States is increasingly made up of Latin American immigrants. Mexico in particular is a gateway to people from other countries. Recently, I was on the border with Guatemala, interviewing Central American immigrants who had just entered Mexico and were on their way to the United States. So I think that Mexico is the Mexican economy, Mexican society is linked, inextricably with the United States. And secondly, the United States itself is becoming more and more of a Latin American country. I wrote a book about this called Translation Nation, defining a new American identity in the Spanish-speaking United States, about the spread of Latin American institutions, of Latin American ideas through the United States. And therefore, especially the southwestern United States, increasingly the Old South, the Confederacy, the states of the Confederacy are linked to Latin America. You can go to a Dalton, Georgia, or a Chattanooga, Tennessee, and meet people of Mexican descent, of Mexican heritage, people who still think of Mexico, who have family there and have part of their souls tied to this place in the South. So there are, Mexico and Central America are linked to the United States in countless ways.
I know certainly here in Texas, where I'm at, Mexico is our number one trading partner. We do a tremendous amount of business with Mexico, and obviously we have a vested interest in promoting the Mexican economy. Now, speaking of economy, we have been following your articles and some of the local articles here and other things on the Internet. There's a lot of stuff going on in the Mexican Congress regarding fiscal reforms. What can you tell us about that? What are some of these reforms, and where are they? I mean, have they passed? And how are these reforms supposed to help Mexico?
Mexico has a very, very poor rate of tax collection. And people here say that evading taxes, tax evasion, is the number two sport behind soccer as the national sport here, the national pastime in Mexico. People always find ways of avoiding taxes. So the tax reform does several things. It's trying to get people in the informal economy, people who sell things on the street corner, or who sell things in a way that is difficult to sort of measure and quantify for the tax authorities, to get them to pay more taxes by taxing cash deposits to banks. It's also sort of streamline the corporate tax code to try to get corporations to pay more taxes. They increase the gasoline tax to try to get more revenue there, in part because Mexico's chief source of foreign revenue, chief source of revenue for the government, is the Pemex oil fields, and those oil fields are in decline. So Mexico is on the brink of fiscal uncertainty, perhaps a fiscal crisis in the coming years and decades, and it needed to sort of address its tax collection issues. And it's also this reform gave more teeth to the tax collection authorities, the Mexican equivalent of the IRS. So that's essentially what the tax reform consists of. It was an attempt to get at the high end and the low end of the Mexican income system and try to get people at both ends to pay more.
Now, you mentioned Pemex, and of course, that has always been a very sore subject with some political groups down there about energy reforms. Do you foresee any? You're never going to have full privatization, I understand that, but were there any relaxation on foreign investment in the energy sector?
That is what we call in the journalism circles. That's a poison pill in Mexican politics. No one can touch that. Anyone who advocates foreign participation in the Mexican oil sector risks being politically ostracized. I don't see that. I live on my way to work every day. I take the bus down Reforma, and I pass by the fountain to the of oil, it's called. It's actually a water fountain, but it's a fountain. It's a monument to the expropriation of the oil fields in the 1930s by President Lázaro Cárdenas. So I think it's something that many Mexicans hold sacred as a natural resource. I think that we might see a way that maybe Pemex can get some foreign companies to help it in oil exploration. That probably is inevitable in a decade or so. But for the time being, that is not going to proceed very well, very, very much at all.
Now, you mentioned that the oil fields are shrinking. I think that's the proper way to put it. That has to be a shock to the Mexican government, because so much of their funding, if you want to put it that way, is based on the idea that oil is selling at $75, $80 a barrel. I mean, if they lose their oil source, what do they replace it with? I mean, what other economic sectors could replace the money that comes in from oil?
Right, there isn't there isn't one. There isn't one. I mean, I think the great hope here a generation ago was that Mexico would become a manufacturing hub for the United States. That you know, the famous maquilas would spread, and that Mexico, what happened in China would happen here in Mexico. But it ended up happening in China more. And you know, even now, you find people who have a factory that produce garments, you know, clothing, and they say, you know, I have to shut down my factory because of all the clothes that come from China. So I don't know what really would replace that. It's something that I think should really concern a lot of Americans, because it's a very potentially explosive situation so close to the United States.
Absolutely, because we've been counting on buying Mexican oil ourselves, you know, for our own national security. Now, a lot of my business customers, I do a lot of U.S.-Mexico operations as part of my regular business. And a lot of Mexicans, a lot of people, when they're talking here, they'll ask the question, you know, why is so much business going to China rather than Mexico? And it doesn't seem to make sense on the surface. Is there a reason? Is it all cost, or is there another reason why so many American businesses are moving their operations to China rather than moving them to Mexico? I know in the case of textiles, I mean, they have pretty much shut down textiles in Mexico.
Very obvious reason, which is staring everybody in the face, and it's because China has an authoritarian government and Mexico doesn't. You know, Mexico had a revolution in 1910 that was enshrined in and the gains and the desires of Mexican working people were enshrined in the Constitution of 1917, which provides protections for union activities and. You know, it's a country that doesn't that has traditions in terms of labor standards that it wants to protect. Of course, they might not be as rigorous as the laws in the United States, but still, Mexico has that culture where it has, you know, and that I think that is costs money. You know, it's harder to fire people here, for example, or hire, you know, when you hire someone. It isn't like the United States where you can just sort of let somebody go. I mean, it just, you know, people believe that they have rights when they're hired to a job, that they that is a right to a livelihood, and you can't take that away for just any reason. So I think that's really the number one cause of this of Mexico being less attractive in the international labor marketplace than East Asia.
I had a company say to me the other day that they're a small manufacturing company here in Dallas, and somebody from China showed up, and pretty much their sales pitch was pretty much along these lines: what does it take to take your business? What price do you want? Meaning, you know, what is the cost of labor that you want, and we'll match it. And so the Chinese are being very aggressive in taking a lot of this business, of course, with consequences for Mexico, as you discussed. We have a couple of other things I wanted to ask you, and always time is running against us. But on the political side, obviously all of us here in the United States, we witnessed the election turmoil last year. How has the country recovered from that almost a year later?
Well, it depends on who you ask in the country. I think that a lot of people on the left really resent the presence of Felipe Calderón as their president, but increasingly he has cemented his power. He has he's performed very competently in his first almost year now in office, and I think he's recognized as someone who is a tough person. He's not someone who's going to surrender or someone who's going to back down, as Vicente Fox did. He's also a very savvy politician. He made deals with the left, the PRD, as it's known here, the Partido de la Revolución Democrática, over the tax issue. He essentially got the PRD not to filibuster, the Mexican equivalent of a filibuster, not to filibuster the tax issue by agreeing to replace Mexico's election authorities, because the PRD, the left, felt that the election was stolen. They wanted to get rid of the previous people who ran the Mexico's Election Institute that oversees all elections, and they got that in exchange for their acquiescence on the tax deal. Calderón made that bargain, and he in doing that also sort of helped cement his position as Mexico's president, a position that not many people were willing. Well, many people were sort of resisting at first, but he's managed to carry himself very well as a political operative, political leader. For example, he gave the grito, the famous yell of independence, last month here in the Zócalo. Vicente Fox wasn't able to give his last one because he was afraid that the crowds below would be whistling and booing him because the Mexico City is very pro López Obrador. But Calderón didn't care. He went out there with his family on the balcony of the National Palace here in the Zócalo and gave his grito. And, he didn't much care whether he was going to be yelled at or anything, and so that's the way he's conducted himself. He hasn't made any public speaking engagements here in Mexico City, but outside of Mexico City, he's sort of cemented the vision of himself as Mexico's president.
Now, this deal that Calderón made with the PRD to change the Electoral Commission, now, that deal, was that deal popular with panistas and with priistas? Because, one of the things that many people told me about Mexico was that the Electoral Commission was extremely popular with the country, and that most people felt that it was honest and independent. So did Mr. Calderón give away something he may regret later, particularly when his party is running for election?
Well, one thing that's not really mentioned much in the debate outside this country, or that people have forgotten, is that the Electoral Institute, called the IFE, Instituto Federal Electoral, its members were named, or supposed to be named, by Congress. But when they were named by Congress several years before the presidential election, around 2003, 2004, the PRD, for whatever reason, abstained from naming the members. So the PRD did not have a say in who the members of the committee that ran the IFE were, the commission of the IFE, or its director. And so the PRD felt, it was obviously a serious political miscalculation by the PRD. And so now there's going to be new commissioners appointed to the Electoral Commission, and hopefully all the political parties in Mexico will agree on who the nominees will be, and there will be people who will be seen as politically independent. So yes, I think there was from some panistas a resistance to the idea that they would get rid of these people, Luis Carlos Ugalde being the head of the IFE, being number one on the list. But I think it was part of the way politics is done. Politics is compromise, and in Mexico it's something new to have parties compromise on something that they feel passionately about. But that's the way things move forward in democratic societies.
Yeah, I was talking to a gentleman Friday night who was visiting from Mexico City. We went out to dinner, my wife and the three of us went out to dinner, and that's one of the things he was pointing out to me, that, that it's a new country now, in the sense that there has to be more political compromise, because, you don't have the presidential system that many of us remember, or perhaps many Mexicans, I guess, if you're over 25, I'm sure you remember, in Mexico, the presidential system. We're talking to Héctor Tovar, or Héctor Tovar. I guess it depends what side of the border you are on. But as you can see, Héctor is a very knowledgeable guest, and he's the bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Mexico. And we're having a lot of fun learning about Mexico, talking to Héctor. One last thing I wanted to talk about, because we always run out of time when we do these things. One last thing I want to talk to you about is immigration. Obviously, that's a subject that is very important on both sides. I'm sure you, being familiar with Los Angeles, you're familiar with the politics on both sides. From the standpoint, the way the media, how does the Mexican media cover this issue? If you're a typical Mexican reading the Mexican media or watching the Mexican media, what do they see about this, or what do they hear about this immigration issue?
For Mexicans, it's the story of their countrymen going to the north and being abused by xenophobic officials and by a country that essentially treats them as slave labor, that brings them to live as second-class citizens in a country, uses their labor, has them cut the lawns, take care of the children, make the food, and then can deport them in a moment's notice. That's the way the story is covered in Mexico. When the marches took place a couple of years ago, the marches for immigration rights, it was a great source of pride here in Mexico. That picture of Los Angeles with a million people in front of City Hall ran on all the front pages here. And whenever there's a large-scale immigration raid, or when there's discussion of an immigrant reform law in the United States, or when Newt Gingrich says something to the effect that the immigrants are massacring American citizens, all that it gets great play in the Mexican media. It's a source of anguish for Mexicans that their compatriots live. I'm talking off of the point of view of the Mexican media, not necessarily my own, but that's the way the story is covered in Mexican.
But is there a segment of the Mexican media that balances that, or is it pretty much that way? For example, when you were talking about the marches, did anybody in Mexico ask the question, what would happen if a bunch of foreigners marched on Paseo de la Reforma with foreign flags and placards?
The only thing you'll find a few of the high-level intellectual commentators who write for some of the newspapers will say, hey, listen, the border is going to close and we have to deal with the consequences of it. It's not going to be an open border forever. The more informed commentary, forward-looking commentary, is that Mexican society has used the border as an escape valve for its social problems. That is, all the people who would stay in Mexico and who would advocate for social change, who would make this a more equal country, or who would march for their rights in Mexico, instead leave, and they march in Houston instead, or they march in Rupert, Idaho, or whatever it is that Mexicans go. And there's a few commentators, intellectuals here, who recognize that Mexico is going to have to deal with the consequences of a more restrained flow of people northward.
Well, not only that, but also the fact that the country has become so dependent on the money going south. I mean, that's a subject that should be discussed down there as well. We're running out of time, Mector. If I had a feeling that we wouldn't be able to get to everything because it's so interesting. You mentioned about your book. Where can you get that book that you were talking about? The book that you wrote.
Well, Translation Nation is published by Riverhead Books. It came out in 2005 and came out in paperback last year, 2006. And it's available at a bookseller near you, and also my novel from a few years back called The Tattooed Soldier. My two books are out and available on booksellers online and at many fine bookstores near you.
I guess you might be able to get it through some of the internet services too, I assume. You might be able to.
Yes, and definitely. You go to a Borders and if it's not on the many times my book is on the shelf, and if it's not, they will order it for you.
And these are the only two books you've written, or have you written anything else? Not yet, huh?
I'm writing a couple of books right now, but I don't want to talk about them, but I also have essays and short stories and whatnot, but I won't bore you with that. In fact, if you want to find out more about my writing, go to www.hectortobar.com, and that's Tobar with a B as in baseball, B larga, as we say here in Mexico. My family's from Guatemala, and we spell Tobar with a B as in baseball in Guatemala. So if you go to hectortobar.com, you'll see my all different examples of my writing and short stories I've written and whatnot.
Well, that's great. We're going to do that, Hector, and we're going to call you back from time to time just to check on on the Mexican situation. It was very informative for me. It was extremely good, I think, for the listeners. And we just, is there anything else, any last thing that you wanted to say where maybe I cut you short or you didn't get
point?
Oh, no, no,
we're always thinking of, you know, of Texas here and of California, because those places are very close to the hearts of Mexicanos, because they're you know, it's almost impossible to talk to someone here in DF who doesn't have a relative in Texas or California. All the time run into them, you know, walking about the city. And so greetings to all the paisanos there in Texas and California and elsewhere in the United States listening who have relatives here in Mexico. And the two places are linked not just by economics but also by matters of the heart and soul.
Let me ask you a critical question now. Now, Los Angeles doesn't have a football team anymore. Are you rooting for the Cowboys now?
You know, I think I like the Tony Romo story. Yeah, definitely. I hated the Cowboys all the time I was growing up, you know, because they would be the rivals of my Rams. And now I, you know, the Rams have gone to St. Louis and I could care less what happens to them.
Right.
I would say, you know, I haven't watched much football a long time, but they are definitely the team of Mexico. Dallas, you know, what Dallas does is covered here in the newspapers, and everyone's very excited about the new quarterback situation over there. And the Cowboys run. They look like the best team in the NFC right now. So
they do right now. They're
excited about that.
Yeah, they're 4-0 right now. So they obviously, you know, they still have some tough games left, but they're 4-0. But you're exactly right. The Tony Romo story is an unbelievable story. Not just because he is the first Mexican American, you know, of any note quarterback. I think Roman Gabriel. I remember when I was in, you know, I don't remember exactly when, but Roman Gabriel used to be the quarterback for the Rams many years ago. And I don't remember if he was from California or where he was from, but I think he may have been the first real Hispanic quarterback. But the Tony Romo story is so amazing because this is a guy who was playing for a small college, wasn't drafted, and he may be playing, you know, he may be playing in the Super Bowl for the Cowboys. So that would be, from a journalistic standpoint, I bet that's a great story to follow.
And there's someone else with a connection to Mexico. I know that his grandfather is from Coahuila, and he's a third-generation Mexican-American and from San Diego. So I think, yeah, definitely, you know, once again, proof that the two countries are linked in many ways.
So you're exactly right. You're exactly right. But listen, Hector, thank you very much. We really appreciate your time. I'll send you a link so you can hear the show and share it with your friends. Best of luck. Continue doing all your great work. We enjoy reading it. And have a great day in Mexico City today.
Thank you very much. Thanks too for having me. Muchas gracias y estamos en contacto.
All right, my friend. See you later. Of course, bye. That was Hector Tovar, the bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Mexico City. And as you can see, a very interesting fellow, very informative fellow. And we will, from time to time, touch base with Hector to see what is happening. One of the problems, of course, when you do these shows, is that there's so much material. There's so much material. We could have gone maybe the whole hour, but we couldn't today. But anyway, we'll bring him back sometime and enjoy the conversation. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas saying goodbye, October 3rd. And today, of course, is the beginning of the Major League playoffs. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure who I'm rooting for. I'm going to sit back
a
little bit.
Please enter the number you wish to call.
Well, I think that signal right there tells me that I got to get out. But anyway, have a great day.
Please enter the number you wish to call.
Okay, that means I have to get out. This is Silvio Canto, and I'll see you on Friday. Bye-bye.
Please enter the number you wish to call.